Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today, I am super lucky to have two guests. They are the creators of the Dantastic Mr. Tox and Howard Podcast, which has, I think at this point, 8 episodes out, and all of them are fantastic, and I've been so enjoying listening. I just had to get them on the show and share their wit and goodness with all of you. They are Dan Rosiniak and Howard Greller. They are both toxicologists. You can see their bios in the show notes. And we have a varied conversation on numerous tox topics that I know you will enjoy. Before we jump in, two conferences to plug. The EMCRIT conference, January 31st, New York City. We still have some tickets left. We now have pricing for nurses, paramedics, EMS, residents, students, etc. Just click on the link on the bottom of the page at mcritconference.com. And then, of course, we have in March, 8th and 9th, in San Diego, we have our ECMO course, the reanimate course, the fifth iteration. We're going to have Dr. Yiannopoulos coming as our special guest, in addition to some other amazing faculty. So if you're interested in that, come on over to reanimateconference.com and grab, I think, the last 2 tickets for docs. We have sold out on nurses a while ago. Okay, enough. Let's get into the heart of the matter. We start off talking about opioids, a topic that has been particularly relevant over the past 2 years or so. Just so you could tell them apart at the beginning, Dan is the one with the Seth Rogen voice. So if you hear Seth Rogen, it is not Seth Rogen. It is Dan Rosiniak talking about toxicology. The other voice besides mine, Howard Greller. Let's jump right in. We get a lot of questions at our program because we are the New York capital of heroin, and I think we might be vying for the win.
I'm gonna disagree with you there.
Now, at this point, Howard quotes some statistics about the Bronx being best in New York City, and it is. If you want to find where people are dying of heroin in New York City, the Bronx is the place to go. But I looked it up, and Suffolk County dominates the Bronx when we look at New York State data. So Suffolk, number one. Yay. Either way, all three of us have intimate experience with this. And the first question I would ask is, we get a ton of pre-hospital and police naloxone use, and they all come in and they all want to leave immediately. Is that okay? And if it's not okay, how long do we have to keep them? Yeah. And do we have to keep them against their will with some form of chemical or mechanical restraint? Why don't we just go right into that question?
Sure, I'll start. I keep them 4 hours. So rationale is long enough to make sure the Narcan wears off. And we've had this discussion a lot with our pre-hospital folks as well, and that there's some data out there that shows the patients after they get a dose of naloxone, the risk of them, you know, being found dead when you search for coroner's records and stuff is pretty low. So a lot of people like to jump on that. But most of that data is out of like Denmark and like Scandinavia, where first of all, they've got a single system. And second of all, they're actually getting heroin. and, you know, the combination in the smorgasbord of stuff people are injecting today is, I think, a lot riskier, and the pharmacokinetics are a lot less known. And the other thing I would always ask with my EMS colleagues is, have you ever had to redose Narcan in patients? And every one of them will be like, well, sure. And then I'm like, you kind of, at least from my standpoint, answered the question. If you've had to redose it, then, you know, we're not very good at predicting who does. When the question comes, what if they want to leave? I sort of view it the way I do any patient who wants to leave. So it depends, first of all, I think, a little bit on their capacity to make the decision. You know, are they with it? Are they in fluid withdrawal? Are they agitated? Then no, I won't let them leave. And you can, and we've, you know, sometimes used the, you know, Jedi mind trick stuff of like, well, you know, we do have police here. But usually don't have to. To be honest, that when I have patients who want to leave, the single thing I do that I think works best is I walk in the room, I look at them and say, no, you can't. And I walk out. And to be honest, I bet you over 90% of the time I get cursed at a lot and they yell at me. And the number one thing I hear is, I'm going to sue you. But they almost never leave. It's this bizarre Pavlovian thing that when some old guy in a white coat comes in and says, you can't leave, most of them don't. But that said, you know, if I've really got someone adamant about leaving, they've got normal capacity, then yeah, I think like anyone else. As long as I know the risks, they can leave. What about you, Howard?
Yeah, I mean, I do attempt the Jedi mind trick as well often. I don't quite have the austere appearance that you do with my Christmas beard, but the
you could just tell him Santa says you can't leave. Right.
You're going to be on the naughty list.
So visuals would definitely help at this point. Howard is sporting a Skid Row Santa beard. I put a picture of it in the show notes so you could check it out.
No, it's something where, I mean, there's the pharmacokinetic argument where as long as you know that the naloxone is going to go away, as long as you wait long enough for that, and whatever feints or other distractions you do, you know, the ubiquitous sandwich, to keep them there long enough to feel like, okay, they're probably okay. Because honestly, most of the time, they're going to go back out and they're going to use again. So if they're using again, is it really the redosing or is it the what they used before now superseding the naloxone? So, you know, a lot of these things are game time calls, and I don't know if there's a one size fits all prescription for how long you wait. Because like Dan said, we're really good at seeing when they need it again, but we're not really good at predicting when they're going to need it.
Dan, the next question I'd ask then is, let's say they get resedated, their respiratory rate drops down to 6, their end tidal kind of fades away. There's been a big controversy in the tox world, at least in the ones toxicologists I deal with, on the ideal dose for naloxone. And I was raised in the New York shops where I'm giving 40 micrograms at a time, and the Chicago people laugh at me and pretend that's homeopathic. What's your take? Let's start with you, Howard. What dose do you give to reverse your opioid toxicity?
Well, you know, I was reared and weaned off of the Gold Frankian teat. So I'm of a similar, you know, ilk. I start with the 40 microgram dose, the 0.04 milligram, and go from there.
Weingart breaking in here, folks. So if you want to give the 40 microgram at a time dose, which I highly recommend, what you do is you take a ampule or a syringe full of the 0.4 milligrams in 1 cc, the standard dose, at least at our shop, that naloxone comes in. And then you take a 10 cc syringe, put 9 cc's of saline in there, and then draw up that 1 cc of 0.4 milligrams of naloxone. And now what you're winding up with is 0.04 or 40 micrograms per ml of naloxone. You give a cc of that, you wait a couple minutes, you give another cc, wait a couple minutes, and you get them to the point where they're breathing and rousable without actually going into forward withdrawal. And I think it was Billy Mallon, my colleague, who said that he's never reversed a patient with naloxone that he actually liked better after the reversal. So keeping them at that drowsy and yet breathing state is the ideal for me.
And again, my goal is primarily just to get them ventilating, and I don't like awake and agitated and withdrawing. So while, you know, I know where some people are coming from, we always have the ability, like anything else, to give more. So I start low and I go from there, as you know, and I always prefer an intravenous route if it's available as my ideal direction. So.
Yeah, I'm similar. It may not be 0.04 always I give, but I start low, go slow is sort of the mantra.
Right.
The problem I have now is that so many of the times the resident or the nurse has already bolused them with a larger dose. But I like the other benefit of the small dose is, you know, I feel like I get a better comfort level when the opioid is out of their system because they'll... You know, you give a fairly low dose and several hours later you've not had to get any more, you know, you're in pretty good shape in terms of that patient going home.
Now, we have had like these arbitrary rules that if you have to give more than 2 doses of naloxone, they deserve a drip and admission. Is that still true? Is that just, you know, old wives' tales? What's the deal on that?
Probably depends where you practice.
Yeah, it depends on what you see and the kinds of agents that people are involved in. If they're requiring repeated doses and, you know, you're in an area where you see a lot of methadone, then they're going to be, you know, they're going to require more doses. And that then becomes more of a convenience factor, more of a nursing intervention than anything else. Because while the ideal way to manage this would be to continue to watch them, episodically dose them when they needed it so they stayed breathing, that becomes time consuming and a real effort on behalf of the staff. Whereas, you know, if it's late, you can put them on a drip, make it titrate it to the point where they're breathing and not withdrawing, and then in the light of day, however many arbitrary hours that is later, take it off and see how they do. And so I think, I don't know if it's necessarily a hard and fast rule, but I think it winds up being a matter of convenience more than anything else.
Fair enough. If you were doing this all on your own and you had them on a drip and now you want to see, maybe I can discharge them now, they look much better. How long would you wait after turning off the drip? Would it be another 4 hours from that point?
That's a nice safe answer. It would also depend on several things, I would guess. You know, if you had a person on a drip all night long, they're wide awake and alert. You know, I usually stop the drip if I'm seeing them in inpatient as soon as we're seeing them. And by the time discharge planning's done, if they've not resedated, they're fine. I don't know that you need 4 hours in that setting if they've been on a drip all night, unless there's some, you know, some idea that this was methadone or some, you know, like, for instance, this is a massive loperamide overdose. And so that's got really crazy pharmacokinetics in massive overdoses. So if it's just a heroin or what we think is some sort of, you know, opioid or fentanyl analog, probably going to be comfortable a couple hours after the drip's off, to be honest.
Fair enough. You know, I listened to that first episode really carefully, and it was just wonderful. And what I took from it, like the main point, was that the solution to all this is just prescribe tramadol. And
yes.
I was hoping you two could talk about why that drug is so good and probably should replace the Percocet prescriptions.
Yeah. Because we like killing people.
So tell us a little bit about tramadol and why this is such a ridiculously bad medication and should never be used.
Sure. Well, you know, the problem I have with tramadol is that what it was designed for, it doesn't really do very well. And what it was supposed to eliminate, it also doesn't do very well. And it has lots of adverse events and lots of unpredictable pharmacology. So to sort of go through those in a nutshell, you know, it was marketed as a pain medicine, but it was largely designed as a non-opioid related pain medicine. And really what you get with tramadol is an SNRI, you know, a serotonin norepi-reuptake inhibitor that is converted by the enzyme 2D6 to an opioid. So you still get an opioid, even if you want to call it structurally a non-opioid, you're still getting the same effects at mu receptors. And because of that, you're still seeing the same risks for abuse, dependency, and withdrawal. Yep. And while it's not as common in the U.S., when you go to places like Egypt, where it turns out that the enzyme that converts it to the opioid, they're much more likely to be a fast metabolizer so that they're going to make that opioid quickly. It's the number one abused drug. So its abuse potential is as bad as an opioid. Its withdrawal is also as bad as an opioid. But the other problems with it is, number one, that it's in some respects better in overdose and worse in overdose. It's better in the sense that they don't get as much respiratory depression, but it's worse in the sense that I've seen a lot of people with status epilepticus.
Seizures,
and it's just incredibly common. So you're just sort of deciding on how you want your brain to go out with pure anoxia, or do you want it to go out with a combination of anoxia and excessive neuronal firing? So, and then the other thing is, because it's an SNRI, there are so many drug-drug interactions. And the patients who get on tramadol, I'm sure, are never patients who are already prescribed an antidepressant. They're also never on trazodone for sleep. There are never people who take over-the-counter dextromethorphan that also. So it's just, there's just too many drug-drug interactions. And so for all of that collective reason, I can't see any good reason why it should be prescribed. It's almost as if when they took Darvocet off the market, somebody said, well, wait a second, we got a really bad opioid that we're taking off the market. It's only fair in the balance of the world that we put another really bad opioid on the market. And poof, we had tramadol.
All right, the next thing we wind up discussing is intralipids for toxicologic emergencies. They had a fantastic interview on the Dantastic Tox Show with Dr. Weinberg, at Lipid Guy on Twitter, one of the original researchers who looked into lipid therapy. This episode was extraordinarily good. I advocate it to every EM and critical care person out there to listen to. Let's go right into the lipid stuff. So the lipid interview was phenomenal, just so, so good. And I'm going to ask both of you, just at what point would you grab lipids and which overdoses and at which stage in them? And then I want to hear a little bit, Dan, about your, I guess the thing, did you discover that actually during the interview, or you had already thought about this extensively about which drug overdoses lipids would be appropriate to?
The Ruciniac rule?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's really funny. The interview and the discussion about it really reconfigured my thought process about it, because I don't want to say I was a naysayer, but I was definitely reacted to the over adoption and the exuberance for the therapy. And I think that in speaking with Dr. Weinberg, my thought process really got really changed around, in that we're not, the two trains are not meeting at the same station, and trying to rethink about how to get the antidote to the place where the drug is working at the right time. And I think Dan's, you know, approach and Dan's thought about something that is both, you know, brain and heart.
So there you go. That is the aforementioned Ruciniac rule. If a drug involves both the brain, like the patient seizing, and the heart, like hemodynamic consequences or QTC prolongation, et cetera, then that is a drug amenable to intralipids. And if it only involves one of those two, then perhaps intralipids are not the right choice. But as you would hear from that interview they did, it's even more complex than that. So listen to the interview to truly understand.
Is at least the entryway, and then all of the other kinetic parameters associated with it are really gonna depend on where we are in the arc of their toxic picture. So I don't know. I'm not sure exactly at this point where I'm gonna reach for it now, because I definitely have to think about it more. But previously I was a, you know, sort of last ditch, they're arresting or a local anesthetic.
I probably am about where I have been. I mean, we're a fairly busy inpatient service, so we get a lot of these overdoses. One of the hospitals we go to is a big transfer center, so we'd get a lot of sick people sent. And so after the initial studies came out and were fairly convincing for its role in local anesthetic toxicity, and there started to come out articles that it might be beneficial in a variety of different drug overdoses, we used it quite a bit. Now, I think we actually got a little discouraged early on as well, and I think a lot of it is because we were using it in the wrong patients, because the ones that I often would think about were the bad amlodipine overdoses. We get these amlodipines, you know, they're profoundly hypotensive, you're doing everything. And when you really look at the lipid partition coefficient of some of the calcium channel blockers, they're not, I mean, there's some that certainly verapamil and others that you think maybe it would work okay based on its, you know, its lipophilicity. But amlodipine was probably not one that I was going to get a huge response. So I think at first we got kind of a little negative. We had a couple bupropion overdoses that we've used it in, and some of the others that sort of led me to think, you know what, the drugs it seems to work in, when I looked at the animal literature, look at the local anesthetic work, it seems to work well in drugs, or at least we believe works well in drugs that can both cause seizures and cardiac toxicity. Now, there are probably drugs beside that it works in, but those are the two big things that I would really look at where I'm like, wow, we've got a really sick patient and they're not responding to conventional therapy. So like a bad bupropion is a good example. Seizing, YQRS, hypotensive in a massive overdose. And the YQRS we know is not very responsive to bicarb because it's not through sodium channel blockade. You know, at that point you're looking at, I'm either going to have to get this person someplace to potentially do ECMO, or again, most people have lipid. Let's go ahead and give them lipid. So for me, it's that sort of scenario where I start reaching for it.
Another terrible drug, by the way.
Oh, Ilbutrin is the worst. Ilbutrin is the worst. I mean, it's a bath salt. Like, why? I mean, yep. It is structurally a synthetic cathinone. It makes your urine drugs positive. The only benefit of people who are depressed was that it made you hyper and lose weight. We would have been better off giving them Coke.
Cane. I
mean, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Coca-Cola.
Right.
No, cocaine. We would have far better off because it would have had a similar effect. So, no, Ilbutrin is, from an antidepressant standpoint right now, the biggest problem we see in terms of toxicity and death.
We started talking about calcium channel blockers. Let's end there. Because there's seemingly like schools of thought on this in geographic areas. There's some places that believe in high-dose insulin therapy and some places that feel it's purely vasopressors that will cure this disease. And it never made sense to me to go either way. It seems like the heart would be an insulin type path and profound vasodilation could be treated by incredibly high dose vasopressors. What's your take on it, both of you? Why don't you go first, Howard?
So, I mean, I think the first is that it's fundamentally, this has to be a sort of an all hands on deck approach. These are the terrible drugs. These are the ones that sort of, you know, in kids and bad dose, overdoses in adults, sort of keep a toxicologist awake at night because they are very, very difficult to manage. And a lot of the therapies that we have or have used in the past are not very effective. And sort of everything has to be sort of done. So, you know, my own journey has gone through an evolution where I remember in residency in the first exposures to this, it was using a lot of glucagon and calcium and pressors and people winding up on balloon pumps and just not doing well. And then sort of evolving. And I think one of the components that I think that we don't talk about often with this is I think in a real calcium channel blocker overdose, decontamination is going to be a very important aspect that is often overlooked because you're too focused on the hemodynamics and can often be difficult because of those same hemodynamics. But, you know, these are overdoses where with the sustained release preparations, eliminating from absorption a single quanta of drug may potentially make an impact down the road. So that has to always still be in the armamentarium of options. I believe in high dose insulin euglycemia. I think that it's effective, but again, has to be started early because its effects are later. And I don't think that there's any problem with utilizing vasopressors as long as, you know, you are also doing the other therapies along the way. You know, bridging them to the time that you think that insulin will take effect, an hour or so with some norepinephrine, I think is fine. But you have to, it's a sort of a comprehensive picture that you have to address.
We're probably in between Arizona and New York, so it's probably fitting that I'm sort of in between those two camps. I didn't even think about that, but geographically it works just about right.
Yeah.
I use everything, you know, so right. I like calcium. And I think there are folks in Australia, for instance, who would argue that we way underdose calcium in these patients and that we don't seem to have a least bit of fear about pushing 10 amps of sodium bicarbonate in a bad TCA overdose, but nobody gives more than a single amp of calcium chloride or three of calcium gluconate. So I will be fairly aggressive early on with calcium, and I think that's fine for a mild to moderate overdose. I am pretty early to throw a pressor on them. I like norepi, and sometimes I like epi, depending on which calcium channel blocker I think and where its predominant pharmacokinetic or pharmacodynamic effects are, whether it's all squeeze or more peripheral or a combo, as with Rapamil. So I sometimes will throw Epion as my presser. But now a lot of them are amlodipine. I'm pretty quick to start with norepi. I don't use glucagon. Some of my colleagues do. I hate glucagon. I think it's useless.
No.
I do.
My
so, it's just, it's one more drip and the pharmacy goes nuts and it makes people, so I'm out. I have no problem. I don't believe there is a ceiling for oppressors, so I agree with a little bit the Phoenix folks. But I am also a start. As soon as you're starting to have to crank up your oppressors, I'm throwing on an insulin drip. And, you know, the nice thing with them is that they're almost always hyperglycemic anyways, and so it's easier to convince the nurses that we really do want to put them on a unit per kilo to start with and that we might actually go up. So I tend to do everything. And this is the one patient population, and I'm fortunate in that I work at a place where we could do ECMO, and we have an ECMO fellowship, which means that there's an ECMO fellow, which means that somebody is really willing and interested in doing it. These are the folks that we have considered and at times called for ECMO. So I'm literally right in between the camp. We'll crank pressors as high as they can, you know, as high as we can.
Well, let's really pin you down on that, because I know what we're talking about, but I want the audience to understand. What is your ceiling dose on norepi in a bad vasodilatory calcium channel blocker overdose?
I don't know that I have a ceiling.
Well, at some point you have to say, no, we're doing something else or adding on a second vasopressor, or just you're not going to go to a million. So I think we can pin you down that there is a limit. So what would be, you know, I say 1 microgram per kilogram. That seems to give people the veneer of authority that,
I like that. I like that. To be honest, I'm going to use the Scott rule. I think that's as good as any. I mean, to be honest, when they're over 15 and 20 and the nurses are calling us and wanting to add vasopressin,
a second
or
one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe that there's a limit in these patients. You know, I guess it would be one thing if you had, it'd be one thing if the drugs were acting on select vascular beds, right? If the calcium channel blockers were, if they were only present on peripheral circulation and not on splanchnic or not on cerebral or not somewhere else, so that you were worried as you were cranking up these doses that you were starting to get profound vasoconstriction and decrease in the perfusion of other organs. But, you know, everything's vasodilated in these patients. So the fact that they're, you know, unresponsive, I think it, you keep cranking up the insulin on those folks, but I don't really worry that much about a ceiling, but I like one. I think yours is perfect. 1 per kilo. That's it. That's what I do.
So then there
it is. Can you splice that in before?
Done. I'll change the voice, make it sound a little more bass,
yes.
a little baritone. What about methylene blue? That little darling, that delightful drug.
I'm going to say
Well, we have one firm puh. What do you say, Howard?
I mean, I love the concept of it,
sure.
Right? And it's only for amlodipine and the dihydropyridines, you know,
right?
You know, decreased nitric oxide. But to be honest, if you really wanted to like do that, well, hydroxycobalamin does that very well.
Sure.
Causes
hypertension.
That's right. And there's data on things like using hydroxycobalamin for vasoplegia from a variety of different conditions. And now cobanamide, that may come up. You know, those may be as good. And there is some research that's looking at some of those agents. I don't know. I looked at the methylene blue data when it came out, and I was never terribly impressed with it. But,
Plus
and these people end
risk
up,
of serotonin syndrome.
Yeah, I was just about to say, they're all on fentanyl drips by that time for sedation, so...
And the hydroxycobalamin at least is seasonal, so
there you go.
Yeah, and it increases their blood pressure. I mean, that's the biggest downside to hydroxycobalamin besides screwing up your labs. It raises your blood pressure because it's a nitric oxide scavenger.
Scavenger, yep.
And now, because you know, consummate professional and such, we're going to wrap it back around to the lipid conversation. So, at which point in your calcium channel blocker overdose would either of you give intralipids, if at all?
I tend not to for the calcium channel blockers. I do for a lot of overdoses, but if I had a verapamil that was at an outside hospital that they wanted to ship that was really sick, sure, I'd try it. Knowing that by the time they got to our center, and by the time we could get ECMO and folks like that in, most of it would be out of their system and not, you know, gunk up the circuit. I might consider it then. But really, for me, it would... I don't use it that often for the calcium channel blockers. What about you, Howard?
Yeah, I don't know if I've used it for a calcium channel blocker, to be honest. So, and again, we're back to the discussion that we had with Dr. Weinberg. I'm not sure that we're going to be targeting it in the right way, putting it where it needs to be at the right time. So I don't know, maybe when I'm doing compressions, maybe.
I think we can wrap it there. That was phenomenally good. Okay, folks, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. This makes me think I need to do a wee update on calcium channel blocker overdose, so I will do so. I probably won't speak to you until the new year, so see you then. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.
I keep rubbing it against the microphone.
You're going to get fired if you talk like that, Howard.
You know what's going to happen. Yeah, he's going to cut that out of context, and then all of a sudden HR is going to be well, then, up if they... in my stuff.